Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. Support for the morning show also comes from the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, now offering the Sports Management Master's Degree Program. Students learn the business skills necessary to succeed in today's competitive sports environment. Flexible degrees for in-demand careers. More at uwp.edu. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm delighted to have with me in the studio a faculty colleague from Carthage College, Dr. John Bruning, Associate Professor of Communications and Digital Media at Carthage. And more to the point today, a huge soccer fan, someone who follows the game extensively and who is, of course, following with tremendous interest, as are people all around the world, the current World Cup competition that is underway in Russia, a tournament that the New York Times just this morning described as a tournament full of strange turns. And that's actually probably something that could be said fairly often about the World Cup, but certainly it's true this year as well. So we're going to talk about some of the specifics of what has unfolded in this year's World Cup, what is likely to still occur. I mean, not that we can predict any scores or anything, but just what matches are yet to come and what drama are we likely to yet experience. And we'll also kind of talk about some basics about the game itself and about the way that the World Cup tournament is set up. And we'll also talk about that vexing question about why the United States isn't there, even though places like Belgium and Croatia and Uruguay are. What happened to America? So, John Bruning, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thanks, Greg. It's great to be back.
Glad we can have this conversation. Real quick, I want to just learn a little bit about your own affection for this game and your own background with it. When did this start?
Well, you know, I played a little bit of soccer as a kid. I think most people come to it through playing it, especially now. It seems like most youth start out playing some soccer, I think boys and girls now, which, yeah, I think is a great thing. So I played a little bit as a kid, but I wasn't really I sort of left the game after I played it as a kid and didn't really come back to it much, even as a fan. But I actually, about 10 years ago or so, I used to do a study tour to Europe. It was actually a modern art and architecture tour that I used to take. And we went to a lot of places in Europe for that tour, including Spain and Italy and England and places where soccer was very big, but I didn't really catch on. And then some of my students, actually, when we were in Barcelona, we were there studying Gaudi and Picasso and Dali, and they happened to get tickets for a soccer match there. It was a Barcelona, FC Barcelona game, and I had really never seen a professional soccer game. I'd never really watched much European soccer or anything, and I went to this Barcelona game, and I just absolutely fell in love with it. I mean, the atmosphere there, it's one of the Camp Nou, which is the Barcelona stadium, is one of the biggest in the world. It's like 90,000 people, and it was just such an amazing experience that I started to follow Barcelona first, and then kind of got passionate about soccer in the other countries. That trip then, I eventually stopped doing it as an art and architecture trip and started doing it as a sports journalism trip.
Oh, handy.
Yes, worked out very, very well. Yeah. And so I've been really all over the world now watching soccer. So we've been to Italy and Spain, Germany, England, France, Holland. Been all over the world with students watching soccer, and I watch it a lot. In recent years, I've gotten more into it as far as a participant. I'm a referee as well, which nobody loves a referee, but right. I do that. So I do referee youth soccer as well on the weekends and that kind of thing. And I do some writing about soccer, too. I write for a publication called Soccer Stadium Digest, which is about soccer and architecture. Oh. So it kind of connects one of the things that I was doing on that initial trip with modern architecture, and now kind of tied in with my soccer passion as well. So I write for this journal on a regular basis about stadiums and stadium architecture as well.
Wow. I'm just fascinated. And I'm also really intrigued by this notion of, I mean, typically it's we who turn on our students to the wonders of architecture or the wonders of opera or whatever the topic, and here these students were flipping on your light switch, so it happened in reverse.
Yeah. It's a wonderful thing when students can teach you something new, and in this case, they really exposed it to me for the first time, and I've never looked back. I really am passionate about it now.
That's cool. Mm-hmm. I wanted to make sure that, although I think it will be fairly evident through the course of this interview, that I'm not really a soccer fan. I don't follow the sport very closely. And I will even confess this, that during a recent trip to Las Vegas, every place I went, if there were screens up, soccer was on.
Sure.
And I remember at several different points watching some match, and you're hearing just this deafening screaming of tens of thousands of people in the stands. And I'm looking at this, and I'm looking at what's actually going on the field and thinking, what are you screaming about? What is the big deal? It just bewilders me, the passion with which people follow this game, and also the universality of this game. I mean, it has swept the globe. And so I guess I'm trying to understand what is at the heart of this. Why do people love soccer so much, both on kind of two different levels? I mean, why do including children all over the world play soccer? Why does everybody love to play this game? And why do people follow it with such passion?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. I think the reason why it's such a global game is largely historical. It was a game that was first started in England, actually, and this would have been at the end of the 19th century, essentially. Mm. And so the far-flung British Empire, because it was so global, they really brought their games with them. It was interesting, actually, rugby and soccer were coming about the same time, both in
really?
England.
Ah.
And so you'll see that with rugby, too. A lot of the European or the British, former British colonies play rugby as well still. So it's basically spread historically with the British Empire. So, you know, in Africa and Asia and all over the world, really, that's where people started to play soccer. And it's really, as you say, really become the most global game. We tend to think about, you know, the big sports being baseball and football and hockey, you know, and those kinds of sports. But those are largely American sports, really, if you think mm-hmm. about it. Most of them maybe are adapted from some games. I mean, baseball in some ways comes from cricket and so forth, and football sort of comes from rugby. So, I mean, some of that comes from, you know, the way they came from British culture originally. But there is a lot of that historical reason. Also, we talked about this a little bit before. It's a game that anybody can play, right? All you need essentially is a ball to play it. And so it doesn't require any specialized equipment of any kind or anything, or no real financial investment, or so anyone in the world, you know, can pick up a ball and essentially play soccer anywhere. So I think that's part of the reason it's become so popular everywhere. And then as far as the passion goes, I think it's just it has something to do, I think, with national identity, actually. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, fans, because everybody plays it, it is a truly global contest where it's fairly equal footing, really, between, you know, as we've seen, small nations and large nations can play it together. But people really feel strongly about their own country's team. And so even though maybe on the field it doesn't look like a lot's going on, and it's true, it is a slower game in some ways to develop, and there's the action is fewer and farther between. But I think it's that kind of nationalist passion, you know, something like maybe we feel in the Olympic Games when we watch our own athletes perform. You know, there's a certain kind of pride that goes with that and a passion that goes with that. And so I think at least as far as the World Cup goes, I think that's part of the reason it's so popular.
Right. I appreciate you saying the point about how there is a simplicity to the game in terms of what is required in order to play it. And in the next couple of days, I'm going to be interviewing an author named Sebastian Abbott about a book called The Away Game, in which he follows some high-powered soccer agents as they go into places in rural Africa, for instance, looking for the next soccer superstar among youngsters playing the game under the most primitive of circumstances. And mm-hmm. as I was first reading this book and thinking about it, I was just wondering, well, how come these athletically inclined little boys in Tanzania aren't playing basketball? Why aren't they playing basketball or volleyball or, you know, other games that mm-hmm. to which they might be equally suited? But you need a net, you need poles, you need basketball hoops. And you really need, ideally, some sort of court.
Right.
And really, you just need some bare ground and either a real soccer ball or something that you kind of create out of the stuff you find in the garbage. Mm-hmm. just about anybody has the game of soccer within their reach.
Yeah.
In a way that really you can't say that about any other sport.
It's very true. It's very true. Most sports do require a certain kind of certain equipment and certainly, I would say, specialized knowledge, too, about the rules and everything. And soccer is fairly simple in terms of its rules also. I mean, there are some rules that get a little bit technical and so forth, but basically, you know, kick the ball into the goal. Don't use your hands. You know, I mean, it's a
right.
very kind of simple game to understand. And so I think maybe that's part of it, too. And you know, children all over the world, as you're saying, they're starting to pick up these kids as you're reading about, these elite clubs are looking for talented kids that are, you know, 8 or 9, 10 years old. So it's really a pretty amazing system.
It really is. And of course, it can be life changing for some little youngster in Africa who might find himself transported to Qatar or some other
right.
country thousands of miles away for and perhaps experience a life he never dreamt mm-hmm. was possible.
Absolutely.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking on today's morning show with John Bruning, a faculty colleague from Carthage College, but today wearing his hat as a soccer nut, soccer enthusiast, let's say. And he follows the game with the great passion and, of course, especially right now with the World Cup competition currently underway. Ahead of us talking specifically about the World Cup, maybe you could say a word about kind of the way professional soccer is played mm-hmm. around the world. I mean, mm-hmm. apart from this special thing called the World Cup that comes around every four years.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Every 4 years.
Yeah.
But I mean, otherwise, between these World Cup tournaments, how and when and within what kind of framework is professional mm-hmm. soccer played?
Sure, yeah. Every part of the world has its own leagues. Every country essentially has their own leagues. The European leagues are probably the dominant leagues, I would say, in the world. So England, Italy, Germany, France, those are really the big four leagues, I would say. But other European leagues are big as well. But then there's also leagues in South America. Soccer is quite big there as well. But also in Asia, Japan and China now have their own leagues. So there's these national leagues. But in those leagues, what's happening is players are playing for clubs, right? So just like teams would be here that don't have anything to do with their nationality, right? So a club in England will have players from Africa and players from South America and U.S. players and European players, and they'll recruit players from everywhere in order to play those games. So those are the games that are going on during the season every year.
And these are geographical clubs? I mean, they belong to a particular city or province or something?
Right, okay. Right. So, and even some cases, like in London, I think there's 13 clubs in the city of London.
Wow.
Something like that. So sometimes it's even down to kind of the neighborhood level where you have clubs. So that's what's going on year to year on a regular basis. The U.S. has the Major League Soccer, MLS, which is a more recent league, maybe not quite up to the standard of the European leagues and some of the South American leagues and so forth. But we do have our own professional league. The World Cup, on the other hand, is played by national teams, right? So every country has its own team. So the players will be scattered all over playing during the season, which is fall to spring, right? So they start playing in late August and they play up until May, essentially, for their clubs. And then these national tournaments essentially happen in the summertime. So every 4 years, every 2 years, they do like regional tournaments, so the European Championships and the South American Championships and so forth. And then every 4 years is the World Cup, and that's the big global tournament. So that's what's going on now.
Right. Mm-hmm. So not everybody gets to play in the World Cup. What is it that determines which countries participate, for instance, in this year's tournament?
Yeah. So there's FIFA, which is the governing body of soccer. There's, I think, about 200 teams. There's about 200 nations that have a team. And so theoretically, any one of those nations can qualify for the World Cup. There's a long qualifying process that goes on for about 3 years, actually, to narrow it down to the teams that will actually get to go to the World Cup finals, which is happening now in Russia. Currently, there are 32 teams that get to go to the World Cup. There's six federations worldwide. So our federation, for example, is essentially North America and Central America and the Caribbean. So those are the teams that we compete with in order to go to the World Cup. But South America is a separate region. Europe has a region, Asia. So there's six total. And they end up sending those 32 teams to the World Cup. And then at the World Cup, you know, which we've seen over the last 2 weeks, essentially, those 32 teams are placed into groups. And then they play to set up the bracket of the final 16, essentially, which is what we're seeing just over the last few days. And today are the final round of 16 games. But there is this long qualifying process that goes on for 3 years where you're playing against other teams from your region and trying to qualify for the final tournament, which is the World Cup.
Right. I don't think you have to follow soccer all that closely, or even the World Cup all that closely, to be aware of the fact that the United States is not competing in this World Cup tournament. So what happened there? Why are we not there? Who knocked us out?
Yeah, it was a surprise. It really was. I think, have been at the World Cup in all the most recent World Cups. We've been there, but this one we actually didn't qualify. There were other teams from our region that qualified. The three teams that qualified from our region were Mexico, Costa Rica, and Panama. So those were the three countries that were ahead of us after this three-year process. And the final game, it came down to the very final game for the U.S. If they would have won the game, they were playing Trinidad and Tobago. And it was in October, and they lost. Wow. So it came down to that very last game in the end, even after this three-year period, and they didn't make it into the World Cup. And it was a really... it's kind of a rare thing that this has happened. The U.S. has qualified every year since 1990. So there was a period between 1950, I think, and between 1950 and 1990, the U.S. didn't qualify for the World Cup. At all. Right. So there was that 40-year period where we just didn't have really the youth programs or the national infrastructure to qualify at all. But since 1990, we'd qualified every 4 years since then. So it was a big surprise that the U.S. wasn't there. And it's been a problem, I think. There's certainly an economic impact to it, too, just in terms of thinking about marketing. In 2014, there was a lot of marketing around the U.S. team. Lots of companies sort of jumped on that bandwagon and got involved. But this year, no U.S. And it's been interesting, too, I think, just in terms of viewership, I think, is down a little bit in the U.S. because we're not involved. 4 years ago, I was in San Francisco for part of the World Cup, and it was great. We'd go out to the games, and the fans were so into it. And then this year, not having the home side involved has certainly maybe interest in it has waned a little bit as a result.
Yeah. As we've already mentioned a couple of times, this World Cup tournament is being played in Russia. What determines where the World Cup is going to be played? Is it kind of like the Olympics, where there's a bidding process with various cities around the world?
Yep, exactly the same, basically. So FIFA, again, the oversight body, they accept bids. I think they go about 8 years in advance. I think they make those decisions. And so countries or groups of countries can put together bids for the World Cup. And so in 2014, they decided the next two World Cups. So 2018 this year was Russia. 2022 is in Qatar. So that will be the next World Cup. There's some concern about that one because it's played in the summertime in Qatar. So it may be a little bit warm. Yeah. They're talking about, you know, actually it's interesting. They're talking about some stadiums that might be sort of air conditioned so that the players can actually play. They've even talked about maybe moving the dates to the winter time or something to sort of accommodate the weather. So that's sort of interesting. But 2026, the World Cup will be here.
Wow.
Yeah, so they just announced that, I think, a week or two ago. The U.S., Canada, and Mexico put together a group bid. So in 2026, it's going to be back in the U.S. The last time it was here was 1994, but it'll be back in 2026. It'll be in 16 different cities across U.S., Canada, and Mexico. I think it's 10 U.S. cities. And then three cities in Canada, three cities in Mexico that will be hosting games. So there's not one real close, unfortunately. I think the closest city is Kansas City. For some reason, Chicago didn't bid, which is a bit surprising maybe. But we're looking forward to that. But it has a lot to do with facilities and the facilities that they have available in terms of who wins those bids. They have to kind of show that they have the infrastructure to handle the fans and the stadiums of a certain quality. In Russia, for example, this year they built a number of new stadiums to accommodate the numbers that FIFA sort of requires for that kind of thing. But again, it'll be very spread out. You know, like Russia, I think it's in 12 cities in Russia all across the country. And here you'll sort of see the same kind of thing in 2026.
Right. Mm-hmm. Maybe you don't know the answer to this, but I am gathering then that what happens is that, for instance, when France plays Argentina, there are all kinds of people from France and Argentina who make their way to Russia and get tickets to that game. I mean, when you listen to the screaming fans, you just assume these are not generic soccer fans that caught up in the game, but that there are partisan fans in those stands from the countries who are participating. So, but you never even know. I mean, if your team's going to win, if they're going to advance, when they're going to be playing and so on. I mean,
right.
But people make their way to wherever this tournament is being played.
Yeah, they do. It is really kind of an amazing thing. I mean, as you say, when you watch the games or see the games, there are large numbers of fans from both of the teams playing. And so obviously those fans are making their way to Russia and finding their way to these various different cities across Russia. It's got to be extremely expensive as well because, you know, the tickets themselves are expensive, but then also I'm sure the hotels locally would, you know, raise their rates and then trying to get transportation into those places.
Well, I mean, right. And what? How can they accommodate all of them? I mean, it's bad enough or hard enough when a city hosts the Super Bowl, and that's just one game, and in a sense, two sets of fans who are ferociously interested in being there. But when you have all of this soccer being played with all of these countries from all around the world, I just am staggered by the math of that.
It is. I don't know. Honestly, logistically, I don't know how they do it. You know, because I mean, as you say, some of the fans don't even know. So the group stage games, you would know in advance where those games are going to be played. So a fan, you know, a Mexican fan who's going to Russia would know Mexico will play three games in these three locations. So that much they could figure out in advance. But then after that, depending on the results, they end up in different cities on different days. But yet those fans are there. They're with faces painted and, you know, horns blowing. It's really an amazing thing to watch.
Yeah. You were saying before we went on the air that you've actually watched quite a few of this year's World Cup games at soccer pubs. So tell our listeners what a soccer pub is, although the name suggests a couple of important ingredients necessary for a place to qualify as a soccer pub.
Yeah. Well, I think it's a trend in the U.S. It's where there are certain bars, essentially, which are dedicated to soccer. And so there are some in the area. I think every city has them. I live in Milwaukee, and there's a few really good ones there. And so it's really a great experience to go and watch these games with other people. You know, it's one thing to watch them on your own TV, and, you know, the games can be fascinating and so forth just individually. But it's so much different to see a game in an environment. It's very close to, I suppose, being at the game and being involved in it. I went yesterday, actually, to a place called Nomad Nacional, which is one of the soccer pubs. The Nomad Pub is a soccer pub that's in Madison and Milwaukee. And they show all the games all year long, so they're very involved in the soccer scene all year. And for this tournament, they actually opened up a pop-up location that's a former very large restaurant with an outdoor patio and a big parking lot where they put up huge screens, and they've got all kinds of things going on there. There was, I'm sure there was, you know, probably a, I would say between maybe 500-600 people there yesterday watching the game.
Wow.
At 9 o'clock in the morning. It was the Brazil-Mexico game. And so mostly Mexican fans, I would say, were there, although there were certainly Brazilian fans there as well. And, you know, it's such a cool experience to see a game with people that are that passionate about it, I think. You know, before the game, they were playing the Mexican national anthem, and the Mexican fans, the Mexican-Americans, were singing their national anthem along with the team and, you know, cheering every single pass and every, you know, defensive play and every save by the goalkeeper. It was just, it's such a unique experience to see it that way. There's a couple of other really great ones. The Highbury Pub, which is on the south side of Milwaukee, a small soccer pub, which is a really great place to watch a game. There's one in South Milwaukee, too, called Moran's Pub. I've been spending a lot of time in pubs, but it's all research, of course.
Of course, yes. And we admire you for it.
But it's all of these pubs are, you know, and they're very, I think like maybe the English pub, they're very kind of family-oriented. And so it's nice to see families there. You see kids there as well, you know, with their parents and so forth watching the game. And so even though it is a pub, it's very much just kind of a location for people to come together and feel that passion for their team together. So I've really had a lot of fun going around to those games.
Fantastic. We're speaking today with Dr. John Bruning, who is a associate professor of communications and digital media at Carthage College, and a soccer aficionado as well, very much so. And we're talking today because, of course, the World Cup tournament is currently underway. We're with two games today. The last of the quarterfinals will be determined, and I think those quarterfinals are played over the weekend. So we're past the halfway point in terms of this current tournament. I think I said at the outset that in the New York Times today they were calling this Russia 2018 World Cup a tournament full of strange turns. So I wonder if maybe you could highlight one or two of the strange turns that occurred in that very first round, where we still had 32 countries represented in various groups. Does anything stand out as particularly big surprises in that opening round?
Yeah, it has been an unusual tournament. As you say, I suppose every tournament is, it's never what you expect to happen. I think that's probably the case. But this year there have been some big surprises. I would say the first one would be Germany. I'm a German fan, so it was near and dear to my heart. Unfortunately, they went out in the initial round. They were the current champions, the defending champions. They won the tournament in 2014 and were favored really again this year. They're the number one rated team in the world. You know, you would expect at least for them to get out of that initial group stage and into the knockout stage, but they didn't. They lost to Mexico in the first round. They beat Sweden, but then they lost to South Korea, which was a huge upset. So that was a big surprise. Germany going home, I'd say, was maybe one of the biggest things that happened in that round. That was a big surprise. I'd say Russia, the home team, is probably one of the other really big stories that's been going on. They're still alive. Nobody really expected that. I think they're ranked like 80th. Or 70th, I'm sorry. They're ranked 70th in the world.
Wow.
So they're really shouldn't be there at this point.
I was just going to say, they're lucky to even be participating.
Yeah, well, and in fact, they're only participating because they got an automatic bid as the home country.
Oh,
right.
Okay.
So they probably would not have qualified if not for the fact that the World Cup is being played in Russia.
Wow. So, for instance, the United States will play in 4 years because we're hosting.
In 8 years, right.
In
2026, yep.
Yeah.
So we'll be in it for sure then if we're not in it in 4 years. So
the home
team gets an automatic bid. So Russia getting past the group stage was a big surprise. They won their initial group of four teams. In those initial stages, there's four teams in each group, and the top two, after they play each other once, the top two move on to the knockout stage. So Russia won their group. They went on to the knockout stage, and then they beat Spain in the knockout stage, which, again, Spain is one of the top-rated countries in the world. So Russia beat them just over the weekend on Saturday. And so they're now in the quarterfinals. They're in the final eight, which nobody expected. They played Croatia on Saturday afternoon. So that'll be a really interesting game. And it's fun to see, I think, the home team do well. It's just nice for the fans.
Of course.
In Russia. So that's I think, a big story. The other story I'd say maybe just from these last few days, the two sort of best-known greatest players in the world, Cristiano Ronaldo, the Portuguese star, and Lionel Messi, the Argentinian star, both of them probably playing in their last World Cup. They're both right around 30 years old, which is old for a soccer player.
Actually, Messi is 31 and Ronaldo is 33.
Aha. Well, you've done your research.
I have. That much anyway.
Right. So it's a question of whether those guys would be back in 4 years, whether they have another World Cup in them or not. Probably not. You know, they're both in phenomenal shape, especially Ronaldo, I think. So they might be back. But both of them lost. Argentina lost to France. And Portugal lost as well in this last round. And so having both of those superstars out was sort of a surprise and a big story as well. So there have been lots of, you know, unusual twists and turns, I would say, in the early part of the tournament.
Right. You made reference to the fact that after that initial round where all 32 teams are competing as groups, sounds like they each play three, and then it's whoever advances gets to the next round, which is called the knockout round or the knockout stage. Mm-hmm. Why is it called that? Are we suddenly talking about sudden death where you're just playing a game and you win or lose and that's it?
Yes, exactly. So after that initial group stage and they've seeded everybody according to the results in that group stage, then it's just a single elimination tournament, right? So there's those 16 teams. They're, as you said, playing the last of those games today. They call it the round of 16, but it's win or go home. So it really is everything's on the line in these games. And that's when it really starts to get good, I think. You know, I mean, the early stage games, they're fun to see. There's a lot of interesting matchups, a lot of really good soccer being played. But once everything is on the line, you know, and they're playing for their country and the stakes are so high, that's when the games really start to get great. So just over the weekend, they've started. And for the next week or so, they'll be playing. So it's an exciting part of the tournament.
Speaking of exciting, the big headlines in the New York Times were about Belgium's victory over Japan 3-2, and they were talking about what an extraordinary comeback this was. And I think I would have to read the article at least once again, maybe twice again, to fully grasp why this was such a big deal. I mean, what made this comeback by Belgium such a big deal? What is this the kind of thing that's quite uncommon?
It is. You know, there's not a lot of goals scored typically in a soccer game, so two or three goals is probably the average. I would say maybe two even is average for a game. And so Japan, Belgium was favored in the game, so they were the heavy favorite going in. And Japan scored the first two goals, and so they were up 2-0. And it was relatively late in the second half. I want to say maybe this soccer game is 90 minutes long. And so they scored their second goal, I want to say maybe 70 minutes into the game. So there's only about 20 or 25 minutes left in the game. So Belgium was down 2-0. It was looking very hopeless. Normally, if his team is down 2-0 with 20 minutes to play, they're finished. I mean, it's very rare that they'll come back from that. They got
just
a goal.
Because goals are so infrequent,
right? So yeah. So it's really rare for a team to score three goals, much less score three goals in 20 minutes, basically.
Right.
So that's really what made yesterday's game, the Belgium game, such a such a big surprise and such a huge comeback because of the fact that they were. It looked very hopeless for them, but yet they were able to come back. And then the last goal, they literally scored with just seconds to play. And so it would have gone, it was tied 2-2, so it would have gone into an extra 30 minutes is what they play if they're tied after 90 minutes. And then if they're tied after those 30 minutes, then they go to what they call penalty kicks. So each team just is kicking from the penalty spot at the goal. So they sort of, it's a shootout format essentially. So there, the very last goal they scored to win the game was just in the dying seconds of the game too. So, I mean, it really made it extra special. It was really one of the best games I've seen in a World Cup.
Wow. I know that with the victory of Brazil over Mexico, apparently one of the real shining stars was a player by the name of Neymar, who apparently is also a figure of a little bit of controversy, as often superstars are. Mm-hmm. What can you tell us about him?
Yeah, Neymar's a really interesting character. As you said, he's the kind of Brazilian superstar of the moment, along with Ronaldo and Messi, I would say, is probably the third kind of huge superstar player. He made headlines this last year. He was playing for Barcelona with Messi, who's, as I mentioned, one of the other really great players. Before last season, Paris Saint-Germain, which is one of the really rich teams, bought him from Barcelona for like $200 million or something like that. So he was kind of the most expensive player ever to be transferred. But he does elicit a lot of controversy as well. He's a very flashy player, I guess you could say. So he sort of shows people up a lot by kicking the ball through their legs. Or I saw the other day he flipped a ball up over his head and over somebody else's head and got it on the other side. So he has a lot of that kind of flair, which is fun to watch as a fan. But I think for the other side, you know, he never really want to be shown up quite in that manner. The other thing I think he's well known for is diving, which is sort of a problem, I think, in soccer generally, is that players tend to exaggerate when they are fouled on the field so that the referee will see it and call it. And Neymar is kind of especially well known for that. You know, anytime he gets touched, it looks like he was, you know, shot essentially. And he rolls around on the floor and is in great pain, you know, to kind of show the dramatic nature of the foul. But then as soon as, you know, the whistle blows, he gets right up and is fine. So, I mean, I think there's that kind of, He's a bit of an actor as well, and so that doesn't necessarily always sit well with people. But he's an exciting player to watch, and Brazil, they're the second ranked team coming into the tournament. So Germany was number one, and Brazil was number two. So they are still alive, and probably one of the favorites. On Friday this week, actually, Brazil will be playing Belgium. So we just talked about Belgium winning against Japan, and that seats the number two team, Brazil, against the number three team, which is Belgium. So the two best teams, at least according to the rankings, left in the tournament will be playing in that quarterfinal. That's just sort of the luck of the draw. But that's going to be a really, really exciting game to watch.
Right. So it looks like the other two quarterfinals that we already know about are France versus Uruguay and Russia versus Croatia. Right. So any thoughts on what's likely to ensue?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. France is a really talented team. I think they're a lot of people's pick, especially now, given kind of the teams that are left in the tournament. I think France is probably one of the favorites. They're a top 10 side as well. They have amazing talent. They have a
a young player who's really sort of been, I think, probably the player of the tournament so far. His name is Kylian Mbappe. So he's an African immigrant to France and plays for the French team. He scored two goals the other night in their big win, and he's just really a dynamic player. He's really fast. He's only 19 years old, but is really kind of taking the tournament by storm and really is really an exciting player to watch. So I think France probably has the advantage over Uruguay. Uruguay, of course, is a very small country, not large at all, but they do have some great players, Luis Suarez and Edinson Cavani, who play in Europe, who are very, very strong players. So that'll be a great game. I think France has the slight edge probably in that one. And the Croatia-Russia game should also be great. As I mentioned, Russia, the home team, has great fan support, has been playing very, very well. Croatia has looked excellent during the tournament as well, so that should be a really strong contest. I'd hate to even pick a winner in that one.
And then the last quarterfinal will be determined, I think, today.
Right.
After two different matches. One will be Sweden versus Switzerland, the other Colombia versus England. So
right. Mm-hmm.
Any thoughts there?
Yeah, of all those four, I think I like England probably the best. They have a pretty strong squad. They're the highest ranked of those four teams coming in. Oh, actually, Switzerland is slightly higher ranked, so they have a good chance as well. But four teams that have all been playing pretty well during the tournament, so it's, again, pretty difficult to decide. I never know with these kind of games, you know. It's really difficult to say who's going to win them, and I guess that's the excitement of watching. But both of those games today, the Sweden-Switzerland game this morning at 9 o'clock and then the Colombia-England game this afternoon at 1 o'clock should both be really excellent games to see who goes on.
What would you say, generally speaking, is the level of sportsmanship in a competition like the World Cup? And I'm thinking not so much in terms of the fans, which obviously can get pretty ferociously intense, but in terms of on the field, generally speaking, what are we usually talking about in terms of the way players on opposing teams sort of approach each other, relate to each other, and so on?
Yeah, I think this level of sportsmanship is pretty good. It's not always the case. And, you know, when the stakes are this high, passions among the players tend to run pretty high, too. So there's certainly, I think, have been instances of where there's been some conflict between players or conflicts between players and referees and that kind of thing. There has been a lot of conflict there. One thing they're doing this year that's different is they have video assistant referees. So they're using video for the first time as a way to look at close calls on goals or fouls or things that are potentially determining the game. And so there's been a lot of conflict about that issue, I think, and players always asking the referees to look at things a second time and those kinds of things has been some conflict. But I think generally, you know, after each game, you see the players are always high-fiving and hugging each other as they're walking off the field. And I think part of it probably has to do with the fact that, you know, most of the year, many of them are playing either together or in the same league, so that they know each other outside of just the context of coming together just during the World Cup. And so I think some of those relationships are sort of established beforehand. So there's pretty good sportsmanship all around, I think. You know, it's supposed to be an event, and all these, I think, international, global sporting events are supposed to be a chance for people to come together to promote understanding, right? I mean, that's what the Olympic Games are all about, and I think in a lot of ways that's what the World Cup is at least hopefully about too.
Right.
So I think, you know, whether it's among the players or among the fans, I think there is kind of value in coming together and playing a game that we can all get involved in. But at the end of the game, we can all shake hands and agree, you know, that a good contest was had by all. And, you know, so I think it's nice to see the fact that countries can, you know, that may have a lot of differences can still really get along in this context.
Right. And I hadn't really stopped to think about this till just now what you were saying, that part of what makes this exciting and puts it in contrast to the Olympic Games, for instance, is the fact that we're talking about one game. So right. We're not talking about fencing and curling and weightlifting and whatever, but we're talking about all of these different countries. I mean, from huge countries to tiny countries, all on the field playing the exact same game. Right. And there's something really clean and direct about that that, in a sense, fuels the excitement and fuels the drama of it.
Absolutely. I think that's very true. As you say, in the Olympics, there are, it seems like with most Olympic sports, some countries play it and some don't. Or I'm trying to think of other ones that maybe everybody plays, maybe like track and field or something. There might be some other events that everybody does. But soccer, I think, is the one game that is played by literally every country on earth, you know. And as you say, we all agree on a set of rules, and everybody can come together for this massive tournament, which essentially lasts 3 years long, and we're in the final, you know, just the final week of it essentially coming up. But it's a really remarkable thing, I think, that everybody can get together on that.
A last question: if you had to plunk down money and and predict which country is going to emerge from all of this as the ultimate champions, what would your guess be?
That's a tough one. You know, I really, as I said, I was rooting for Germany early on, but they went out early, so I really have no special expertise, that's for sure. But
well, and let me ask you also, is there a team you're rooting for that you would love to see win?
Yeah, I really like the French team. I think they're extremely talented. I've seen a lot of those players play on some of my European trips, so it's kind of fun to follow those players that I'm familiar with. I think, for me, France, Belgium, Brazil. One of those three teams will be the eventual winner. The final is on Saturday, the 15th. That's when the very final game will be. It's at 10 o'clock in the morning on the 15th. So it's sure to be a great game, no matter who's in it. But I guess if I had to pick, I think Belgium, maybe. I put that on air now, so I can't take that back.
No, you can't. No, you can't. All right. Well, we know that on July 15th, you will not be in church. You will be in front of a screen someplace watching soccer, watching that dramatic final match with whoever it ends up involving. Well, John Bruning, I really appreciate all that you've shared today in terms of helping us understand how this tournament is put together, kind of the unique drama that is part of the World Cup tournament. And I know I've learned a lot, and I'm sure our listeners have as well. And so we can watch the rest of what ensues in the remainder of the World Cup with a little better understanding now, and you've helped us understand how we got here. So, John Bruning, Associate Professor of Communications and Digital Media at Carthage College, thank you so much for this.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
There's no morning show tomorrow because of the 4th of July holidays. We will be closed. On Thursday, though, I'll be sharing my interview with the author of an intriguing book called Grateful that explores some of the ways in which gratitude can and should be a part of our daily lives. On Friday, I'll be replaying from the archives my interview with Tim Madigan, the author of the book I'm Proud of You, which recounts his friendship.